The Margle started to recover from the stench. Jason moved out of the encirclement he had placed himself in, but was only a step away from the reach of those razor claws. One such claw swiped at him, and he lifted a forearm to take the strike. The claw raked through his cloth armor like it wasn't there, cutting deep gouges in his arm. Then, like a burst balloon, leeches erupted from the wound to spray out over the Margles. The monsters panicked, yelping in horror as leeches dug into any available patch of exposed skin. Leeches buried themselves into monsters' arms, bodies, and even faces. The Margles scrambled to tear them off, but every leech tossed aside took with it a chunk of flesh in its lamprey-like teeth. One Margle pulled a leech from its eye, which burst into goo as the leech came away. Sanguine Horror has inflicted bleeding on Margle. Sanguine Horror has inflicted leech toxin on Margle. Sanguine Horror has inflicted necrotoxin on Margle. The leeches that didn't land directly on the Margles started accumulating in a pile, lurching towards the Margles at the back, who had been missed in the initial spray. Jason raised his arm at the Margle that had cut into him and chanted a spell. "Your blood is not yours to keep, but mine on which to feast." The Margle's life force started glowing dark red from within its body, before siphoning off in a stream towards Jason's extended hand. As it sank into Jason's skin, the claw marks on his arm closed. It didn't heal completely, but open wounds became bright red welts. By the time the Margle's life force retracted into its body, it looked weak and pale. Jason kicked it into its fellows, and once again launched himself into the stricken pack of Margles. Jason danced through the chaos, dagger flashing, elbows and feet lashing out. Special attack, leech bite, has inflicted bleeding on Margle. Bleeding already in effect. Bleeding is refreshed. Special attack, leech bite, has drained health and stamina. He did not go for quick kills, instead working to keep the large group distracted and panicked. Yelps and wails came from the Margles as they thrashed about. The stench of the smoke was still in the air, and leeches dug into their flesh. Afflictions turned their blood black with poison, even as it leaked from their bodies. Through it all moved Jason, like a demon conducting an orchestra of the damned. The Margles followed his direction, their screams of misery his music, until the last monster was dead and the air fell silent. Every part of Jason not shrouded in his cloak of shadows was painted red and black with the tainted blood. At his feet, the leech swarm surged, gorged to bursting. Jason reached down, slicing his hand on a claw for the leeches to clamber back into his bloodstream. Humphrey watched as Jason walked back. Behind him, the rainbow smoke of a dozen monsters drifted into the sky. It also rose up from his body as the blood of his enemies burned away. The rest of the trip back to Greenstone was almost entirely silent. Although a bottle of crystal wash had cleaned away the residue of the fight, it was as if the other adventurer candidates could still see the blood painted over Jason. Through the Farsight crystal, they had watched him play the creatures to a screaming, suffering demise. Even Humphrey was shaken. He could tear through a pack of monsters better than any of them, but the worst he could do was burn a creature to death with his fire breath ability. He had never seen anything like Jason's symphony of horrors, shrieks of despair made into unholy music. As for Jason, he was eerily still in the back of the wagon, staring out at the Delta landscape. The horrors he had wrought played out again and again in his mind, but they did not horrify him. For the first time since arriving in his strange new world, he didn't feel like a helpless pawn of fate. He was in control. He had the power. What troubled him was not that his moment of catharsis was marked by the screams of the dying. It was that he couldn't ignore the part of himself that wanted more. The sky grew darker as the wagon passed through cut-down flatland around the old city wall and through the city gate. After the sprawling delta, everything felt pushed together in Old City, from the narrow streets to the buildings crammed against one another. The wagon rolled through up Broad Street Boulevard, which, in spite of the name, would barely pass as a laneway on the island. Stalls were packed away and storefronts were closing with the setting sun. Jason noted Jory's clinic as they passed it by. The Broad Street Bridge was the same one Jason had crossed on his first day in Greenstone, the wagon getting waved straight into the rich people lane. The pace picked up on the wide island streets, and the wagon soon pulled up at the Adventure Society's marshalling yard. The sun was completely gone by the time they arrived, but Jason's mood had lightened. He hopped free of the wagon, feeling like a different man than the one who climbed on a week earlier. He had a sense of power about him, of control over his own fate. "And here we are," Vincent said, as the candidates decamped from the wagon. "Results of the assessment can be collected from administration individually as of tomorrow afternoon. If you wish to challenge or query the results, you may do so with administration at the time you collect them." The marshalling yard was thoroughly illuminated by magic lamps, and a small crowd was awaiting their arrival. The other group had apparently just arrived as well, already being greeted by waiting family. Humphrey spied his mother, fending off several would-be social climbers, and headed in her direction. Jason spotted Rufus standing next to her, but also noticed Thadwick Mercer. From their body language, he guessed Thadwick was being met by a household servant rather than a family member. Jason walked in that direction, calling out Thadwick's name.
"What do you want, Asano?" Thadwick asked, warily.
"I wanted to apologize," Jason said. "There are flaws in my character that sometimes lead me to be smug, childish, and a little too impressed with myself. Last week, I subjected you to all three." Jason held out a hand. "I'd like to apologize and start fresh."
"You think I'd even touch you?" Thadwick asked. "You went out of your way to make me look like a buffoon, and now you think I'll take your hand? You aren't worthy to breathe my air."
Thadwick stormed off, leaving Jason standing there alone, holding out his unshaken hand. "Ah, well," he said, and turned in the direction of Rufus, Humphrey, and Humphrey's mother. Vincent had already moved to join them, and they were all looking in the direction of Jason's encounter with Thadwick.
"Danielle!"
he called out with a wave as he approached. He flashed Humphrey a grin, and Humphrey's shoulders lost some of the tenseness they had been carrying since Jason's fight with the Margles.
"Nicely done with young Master Mercer," Danielle replied with a smile. "I do hope you're paying attention, Humphrey dear."
"What?" Humphrey asked.
"Jason," Rufus scolded. "Stop making a spectacle of yourself."
"Oh, do leave him alone, Mr. Rumor," Danielle said. "He knows what he's doing."
"I think I might have missed something," Humphrey said.
"Same here," Rufus said unhappily.
Danielle sighed, giving Jason a sympathetic look.
"You're wasted in this city, you know that?" she asked him.
"I do," Jason said, shaking his head with mock sadness. "But you can't help where some lunatic cultist summons you to."
"What?" Vincent asked.
"Would you please not provoke Thadwick Mercer?" Rufus asked.
"Or weirdly flirt with my mother," Humphrey added.
"Humphrey, dear, Mr. Rumor," Danielle said. "You have to remember that Jason wasn't born on the top of the pile, like you two. He has to make his own place in society, which is why he's playing around with poor Thadwick."
"Then why humble yourself in front of him?" Humphrey asked Jason.
"Because then I'm the reasonable one," Jason said.
"But he stormed off," Humphrey said. "Doesn't that make you seem below him?"
"It isn't about what Thadwick thinks," Jason said. "It's about all these nice people here. The people who saw me seem perfectly reasonable in front of a member of the Mercer family, then wander over here to where I'm on a first-name basis with Danielle Geller herself. Where does that put me in their eyes?"
"Right at the top," Rufus realized. "But why bother? You're already appearing in high social circles."
"As an adjunct to you," Jason told him.
"What all this is really for is the people who recognize what I'm doing and why."
"Wait," Humphrey said. "I thought it was about all the people here. You're manipulating Thadwick and all these people for the benefit of the ones who see through it all anyway."
"Now you're getting it, dear," Danielle said, happily.
"I'm fairly certain I'm not," Humphrey said.
"Dear boy," she said to him, "the people who know what he's doing recognize and respect his ability to do it. That's how you earn a place in the back rooms, not just the ballrooms."
"I still don't follow," Humphrey said.
Danielle sighed.
Sometimes I think you and your sister are a little too much your father's children. Come along, everyone. I have a carriage waiting and dinner prepared. You will join us, won't you, Mr. Trenslow?
It would be my honour, Lady Geller.
Chapter 61 Trade Hall. Jason looked at the various suits of cloth armour draped over the balcony. He had taken three with him on the field assessment, and each had come back covered in rents and tears. Gary stood next to Jason, also looking them over.
I'm going to need some new armour before I take any contracts, Jason said.
I told you that you needed something heavier,
Gary said.
The armour was all heavy fabric with a few reinforced sections. A combination of magical construction and alchemical treatment of the fabric made it tougher than it looked, but the effect was limited.
I don't want to lose the flexibility, Jason said. My powers are better suited to speed and mobility, healing up the occasional hit.
Then, if you won't increase the bulk, Gary said, you'll need to increase the quality.
Meaning something more expensive, Jason said.
That's right, Gary said. It's not like you don't have the money. And can you really put a price on not dying?
That's certainly hard to argue against, Jason said. And I do still have a decent amount of money.
You should definitely buy something good, Gary said. But don't take it too far with iron rank armor. Just find something reasonably protective and save up for bronze rank. What you really want is something that has a self-repair enchantment, which will save you a good lot of money on repairs.
Do you know where I can find something like that? Jason asked. I looked around at the Guild District markets, and these were the best I found. He pointed out the bedraggled suits of armor.
There's only one place to go for the really good stuff, Gary said. You're an adventurer now, so you can start enjoying the perks.
Jason hadn't been allowed entry to the Adventure Society Trade Hall, but he had seen it from the outside. It was a huge complex of buildings just off the Loop Line station, with several annex structures connecting off a massive central building. It was a huge bazaar, restricted to members of the Adventure Society, along with traders who received dispensation to operate there. It was where adventurers could trade away any valuables, sell off old equipment, and buy gear and supplies for their adventures. Jason's acceptance to the Adventure Society had been confirmed, but he was yet to receive his badge. His access to the trade hall was granted with a temporary permit he had been given along with the results of his assessment. Inside the main hall, Gary led the way as they merged into a crowd as packed as any old city street market. It was a vast open room, three stories high, with two mezzanine levels. Light poured in from a series of skylights that made up the bulk of the ceiling. The ground level was a boisterous mix of stalls, ranging from the semi-permanent to the very temporary. Some were just an open tent, with a few items laid out on a table. Others were essentially full stores, constructed from artfully dyed and woven reed panels, complete with signage. Most fell somewhere in between, but all were swarmed with people, almost shoulder to shoulder.
I didn't realize there were this many adventurers, Jason said, speaking loudly over the din of people.
A lot of them aren't active adventurers, Gary said. Mostly they're essence users from the aristocratic and wealthy families who joined the society for the benefits, like the right to come here.
But they had to pass the field assessment, right?
Not all field assessments are alike, Gary said. Just ask Rufus if you want to hear him complain for an hour. The problem is worse here than in most places.
What about monster surges? Gary asked. They have to front up for those, right?
They do, Gary said. But most places have what's called a reserve program.
Meaning they get to stand at the back?
That's the one.
Gary led him to the side of the hall, where arcades led toward other buildings in the complex. But instead of leaving the main hall, they took one of the broad stairways leading up.
The main floor is all iron rank stuff,
Gary said. Next floor up is bronze.
The second and third floor were mezzanine levels. Gary didn't pause at the second, leading them up to the third.
The third floor is silver rack? Jason guessed. No, there isn't the market for it here, Gary said. Apparently there's only 40 or so silver rankers in the whole city, and they aren't very active. The magic level here is too low, so silver rank monsters are rare. Any silver rankers here permanently are semi-retired at best. People like Danielle Geller and Thalia Mercer are only here in anticipation of the monster surge.
So what is the third floor for? Jason asked.
Brokerages? Most adventurers can't be bothered with the trouble of renting a stall and waiting around for people to buy whatever random pile of loot they have. Brokers buy almost anything of value and sort it for more effective sale. For a percentage, of course.
That's fair enough.
Brokers also organize the auctions, Gary said. In a smaller city like this, they'll usually hold on to the valuable stuff like essences and awakening stones. Then the brokers will work together to hold a big auction event. Once we finish that shield, that'll sell at auction.
The most valuable item Jason looted during the field assessment was the shell of the rune tortoise. Finding an intact one was rare and lucrative, as they could be turned into magical shields. Gary and Pharaoh were going to work on it together, then split the profits three ways with Jason.
Most brokers also do money-changing services, Gary said. If you want to split a coin, say bronze down to iron, they'll do it for free. If you go the other way, they charge 10%. That's standard everywhere, so if they ask for more, just go somewhere else.
Gary led them to a brokerage office, where they were greeted by a receptionist. They were quickly led into a room where they were met by an item assessor, who would value the item so they could get paid. They just had to put out everything on a table for the assessor to go over. Jason put out the various items he had looted from monsters. There was bark lurker hide, monster cores, and a variety of loose quintessence gems. On Gary's advice, Jason kept certain items, but most of it was cleared out to make room in Jason's increasingly full inventory. Even if many items stacked into a single slot, he was getting close to filling all 40 spaces. Jason had a strange moment as he took out the magical robes he had taken from Landomir Vane. Landomir was the very first person Jason met in his new world. He was also the first person Jason killed. It had been less than 2 months, but he felt like a completely different person from the concussed, panicked idiot in the Vane family basement.
Something wrong?
Gary asked, and Jason realized he was staring into space, the robes held in his hands. The blood had long since been cleaned off of them.
I'm fine, Jason said, putting the folded robes on the table.
With fresh coins added to the currency counter in his inventory, they headed back downstairs and into the main hall. Making their way through the throng as they looked at the goods on offer, Jason spotted a familiar face. Jory's stand wasn't one of the permanent stalls, but it was one of the larger ones. At the front was a glass counter, lined with colourful bottles and vials, behind which stood Jory himself. Most of the stall was storage space, hidden behind a curtain. While Jory was selling a woman a bottle of perfume, Jason perused the chalkboard beside the counter, listing the available products.
Crystal wash, he read out loud.
Seriously? Jory asked, as his customer rejoined the crowd. I can only make so much of it, and there are other people who want to buy it. People who don't get the friend's discount.
You realize I had to trudge through a bog marsh, right? To protect the poor, innocent people of the Delta?
Jory groaned.
I can give you one crate, but that's it for the week.
12 bottles, Jason said.
I can't get by on 12 bottles. You do know about showers and baths, right?
He cleans his teeth with it,
Gary said.
What?
Jory said.
It leaves my mouth feeling fresh.
Well, if you want more, Jory said, I'm not the only alchemist here.
What about those assistants you were talking about getting from the Alchemy Association?
Jason asked.
Expanding my operations isn't something I can just do on a whim, you know. I have a lot of demands on my time.
I thought that's why you wanted the assistance, Jason said. Someone to take over the grunt work. They paused for Jory to sell an adventurer a bundle of potions.
It isn't that simple, Jory said, resuming their conversation. If I'm going to do it properly, I need to put together a whole new facility. Extra space, new equipment, wages for the assistants. You know the kind of margins I work under.
That's fair, Jason said. Have you considered investors?
You offering?
Jory asked.
Jason held up a hand, 3 gold coins stacked between his thumb and forefinger.
Something like this get you started?
The basic coin of the realm was the lesser spirit coin. Iron spirit coins were worth 100 lesser coins, used by bulk traders, adventurers, and other members of the wealthy elite. After that, it was 10 iron to the bronze, 10 bronze to the silver, and 10 silver to the gold. The gold spirit coins in Jason's hand was worth 300,000 units of the basic currency.
You're not serious,
Jory said, to which Jason placed the coins down on the counter. Jory hesitantly picked them up, peering at them nestled in his palm.
Do you know how many people I can help with this kind of money?
Jory asked.
It doesn't matter how many people you help, Jason said.
What matters is if this gets me another crate of crystal wash.
I still can't believe you gave him all that money,
Gary said, as they made their way through the crowd.
It's an investment.
In what? That guy spends all his money on helping sick, poor people.
But imagine a world where everyone gave money for things like that.
Gary thought it over for a moment.
Then there'd be more healthy poor people?
Jason allowed himself to be led by Gary's expertise as they looked at various armor for sale. They checked out large stalls selling armor in job lots and small stalls with expensive handcrafted work. The main hall was only the beginning of the Grand Bazaar. Side corridors led to sprawling arcades lined with boutique shops. Jason spotted one with a sign so long it threatened to encroach on the abutting storefront. Gilbert's Resilient Attire for the Discerning Gentleman. Jason walked inside, which was a large open space lined with armor of the lighter variety Jason preferred, largely cloth and leather. Most of the wares were draped over mannequins to demonstrate the hang of the garb. Several customers were perusing the wares, along with the proprietor, in a frock coat that bulged heavily in the middle. Jason recognized the middle-aged man's paunchy frame and balding head.
Bert, Jason said.
Indeed I am, sir. Gilbert, of Gilbert's Resilient Attire for the Discerning Gentleman. For fine men as yourselves, however, I invite and appeal upon you to call me Bert. I take it from that glint of recognition in your eye that you are familiar with one of my brothers. Please tell me it isn't Filbert of Filbert's Fine Leather Emporium.
No, Jason said. I'm Jason, and this is Gary.
Gary waved vaguely from where he was already inspecting the merchandise.
I've met Bertram and Albert and Herbert, but not Filbert, Jason said.
You're quintuplets?
Actually, it's octuplets, Gilbert said.
There's 8 of you.
Indeed there are, Gilbert said. There's Robert, who sells fruit with Herbert, but on the island instead of Old City.
Selling the same fruit, but charging 3 times as much.
I knew you for a gentleman of discernment, Gilbert said. There's also Hubert, but we don't really talk about him. Got caught up with a criminal element. That just leaves Bertrand. He's the handsome one.
You aren't all identical?
No, we are.
Jason was about to inquire further when Gary jostled his arm.
There's some quality stuff here, Gary said. Take a look at this.
Ah, Gilbert said. Trapweaver silk, alchemically treated for maximum resiliency. Leather panels carefully placed to provide additional protection without compromising flexibility. The magic is integrated right down to the weaving pattern of the cloth. Tricky and laborious work, but the results speak for themselves. It also allows for the loose, flowing design, which is quite unusual with protective wear.
Just as Gilbert said, the armor was almost a robe in shifting shades of dark gray. The more fitted parts around the torso, arms, and legs had black leather panels, but the layered garment was also draped with flowing cloth. It was a strange combination of tactical armor from Jason's world and some kind of wizard robe. Jason was immediately taken with it.
There's a mythological order of dark warrior mystics where I come from, Jason said. They dress like this. I don't suppose you know where I can get a sword with a blade made of red light?
Not in this city, Gary said. I've seen some gold rank weapons like that.
Nice, Jason said. I have to start ranking up.
You're a long, long way from gold rank, Gary said with a laugh. You should keep your eyes on what's in front of you for now.
Gilbert smelled a sail and continued his spiel. The mix of shades and the flowing lines are of value to clients who value stealth, Gilbert said, continuing with his sales pitch. While not assisted by magic, the drape of the fabric breaks up the lines of the body, making it harder to recognize in the dark.
That actually does work, Gary said. Although, it doesn't really matter with that cloak of yours.
Jason reached out to run his fingers over cloth, which felt smooth and sleek. Item, Trapweaver Battle Robe, Iron Rank, Epic. A full body armor carefully handcrafted from the silk and leather of Trapweavers. Armor, cloth, leather. Effect, increased resistance to damage. Highly effective against cutting and piercing damage. Less effective against blunt damage. Effect, repairs damage over time. Extensive damage may require external repair. Effect, absorbs blood to prevent leaving a blood trail. Effect, increases resistance to bleed and poison effects. Effect, resistant to adhesive substances and abilities with adhesive effects. Effect, adapts fit to the wearer within a certain range.
Well?
Asked Gary, familiar with Jason's ability to examine items. I like it. I like it a lot.
It'll probably cost more than you should really spend, Gary said. But you should always spend a little more than you want to on armor. It'll keep you alive.
No wiser words have ever been spoken within the walls of my establishment, Gilbert said. Gary took on the job of haggling the price down, both he and Gilbert seeming satisfied with where the number landed. The price was in bronze coins, unusual for iron rank equipment, but Jason had no issue for the quality of the product. He had only seen a handful of epic-quality armor in all their browsing, none of which met his needs so well as the one he finally purchased. After paying for the armor, Jason placed it into his inventory. He pulled up the outfits tab, slotting the armor into a new outfit. He then tapped the equip button, and obscuring smoke suddenly surrounded him. It cleared a moment later, his clothes gone and the armor in their place.
"Very impressive, sir," Gilbert said, without apparent surprise. "And, might I say, it suits you well. Please do see for yourself."
Gilbert pointed Jason to a standing mirror in the corner, where Jason admired himself in the dark combat attire.
"I think I'm having a Chernobyl moment," Jason said. "My apologies, sir," Gilbert said, "but I'm not sure I grasp your meaning."
"We find it's better not to ask," Gary said.
Jason's shadow cloak appeared around him, merging well with flowing lines of dark armor.
"I'm definitely having a Chernobyl moment."
They left Gilbert's resilient attire for the discerning gentleman, with Jason back in his street attire.
"I like how loose it feels," he said. "I wasn't sure about all the really loose clothes they wear here, but once I started wearing armor, I really missed it."
Jason had long ago bought fresh clothes, discarding those he looted from the Vane estate. Day wear in Greenstone wouldn't look out of place at a tropical resort, with bright colors and loose fits. Evening wear was more fitted and formal, with flaring frock coats in dark, sober colors.
"I like it too," Gary said. "Finding clothes comfortable over fur can be a pain. You should see what they wear where I come from. It's basically just underwear and a bunch of belts strapped over everything."
They were making their way through the crowds in the direction of the exit, but Jason stopped when he spotted a stall.
"What is it?"
Gary asked. It was a large stall selling recording crystals. Jason's eyes fell on a box of crystals being sold in bulk, which he pointed out to the bored-looking woman behind the counter.
"How much?"
Chapter 62. Have Some Damn Adventures.
"Hello," Jason said, waving at the crystal floating in front of him. "I'm not sure if, or when, you'll be seeing this,
But I didn't die, or whatever you think happened to me. You probably know that, since the only way you're likely to see this is if I give it to you.
He let out a dissatisfied groan.
Maybe I should have scripted this. Oh well. Where should I start? It's been about 2 months since I arrived here. Where is here? That's complicated. I've made some friends, I just got a new job, although I haven't started yet. They're meant to be sending my ID over today. The application process involved sort of a week-long retreat, which I got back from a couple of days ago. He took a deep breath. I suppose I should start with that complicated question of where I am. Right now, as you can see, I'm in an expensive hotel suite. It isn't actually mine that's across the hall. This one belongs to some of those friends I mentioned. They went 3-bedroom, which came with this nice open living area. Jason had purchased recording crystals that gave him a lot of control about how they moved. He got up and led it out to the balcony, where he panned it over the ocean view. Nice, right? One of my new friends is kind of a big deal, so he got the best room in the house. We're on an artificial island, which is pretty crazy given the size. At some point, I'll do a tour video. The subways here are amazing. Jason, Farah's voice called out from inside. Who are you talking to? Jason went back inside. Although he hadn't been out on a job yet, having passed muster with the Adventure Society prompted Rufus to declare Jason ready to guide his own training. Although he and the others would provide occasional guidance, the hours of intensive oversight were a thing of the past, leaving the others with more time for their own pursuits. Farah and Gary had been working on the rune tortoise shield they were going to sell off, while Rufus was preparing to expand his family's interests into Greenstone. I'm talking to my family, Jason said as he walked back inside. Farah and Gary had just returned.
Your family?
Farah asked. It's a recording stone, Jason said. I've decided to make a record of my time here, something I can show them if I ever get home. Family, this is Farah and Gary.
Hello,
Farah said, giving the awkward home movie wave that apparently transcended realities.
Hey, Gary said, waving enthusiastically. Hello, Jason's family.
Didn't the Goddess of Knowledge tell you that you definitely would get home?
Farah asked. I'm not wildly trusting of authority figures, Jason said, deactivating the crystal. He took a carousel out of his inventory, full of recording crystals in little trays. He stowed the crystal away in an empty slot and returned the carousel to his inventory.
You do realize the Adventure Society you just joined is a world-spanning organization, right?
Farah asked. A global authority. I'm anticipating the odd bit of friction, Jason said. I know I'm not to everyone's taste, but coming to this world is a chance to be who I am. Take it or leave it.
Even if it kills you, Gary said cheerfully. You decided to keep the thing that'll randomly send you home, then?
I did, Jason said. I could always change my mind, but being here has given me some perspective on what's really important. I hadn't seen most of them in a long time.
What happened between you?
Farah asked. The love of my life cheated on me with my brother. Then they got married, and my mother basically told me to shut up and take it like a man.
Harsh,
Gary said. We never really got along, Jason said. My brother is everything she ever wanted in a son. It was kind of the other way around with Dad. It was always him and me. But after the way things were, I didn't see him so much. There was a knock on the door, and Gary let Vincent in. They all sat down in the lounge area, and Jason put out a tray of snacks he took from his inventory.
You just had those ready?
Gary asked, picking up a candied grape. Turns out my storage space maintains freshness and temperature, Jason said, which is lucky, because I had that tyrannical pheasant meat in there for almost 2 months.
You mean the meat I had the other day?
Gary asked. That's the one, Jason said.
Is that why you didn't want any? Were you testing it out on me?
I wouldn't worry me, Jason said. I resist poison.
But I don't, Gary said.
You're bronze rank, Jason said. It'd be fine. If you're worried about the food I make, you don't need to eat any of these snacks.
Gary looked at the candied grape in his fingers, then put it into his mouth.
We don't have to go that far, he mumbled.
Vincent watched the exchange with raised eyebrows.
Are you two quite finished?
You sound like Rufus, Gary said.
I don't think Rufus could pull off that mustache, Jason said.
Jason liked Vincent. He was a very serious man with a very outrageous mustache, which Jason appreciated.
There's been a slight problem with your society badge, Vincent said.
After receiving confirmation that he had passed the assessment, Jason had undergone the final process of becoming an Adventure Society member. Each member had a badge that served various functions beyond proof of membership. It let members claim adventure notices and allow the society to track members in case they went missing. It also let the society know immediately when a member died. Badges were managed by the Adventure Society's Member Logistics Department, of which Vincent was one of the chief officials. In addition to the assessment and induction of new members, their responsibilities included the dispensation and monitoring of membership badges. Although the badges were managed by the Adventure Society, it was the Magic Society that created them. Jason had been sent to the Magic Society so they could take an aura imprint from which to make his badge. It was a simple process, just standing in the middle of a magic circle for about a minute.
Every time a badge is made, Vincent said, it's paired with a tracking stone. It tells us if you're alive or dead, and lets us find you if you go missing or die. Yours doesn't work, though. This stone can't track your aura imprint.
I've seen this before, Farrah said. Some people have abilities that block magical tracking.
That was the Magic Society's assessment as well, Vincent said.
Farrah turned to Jason. You have the Dark Essence, right? She asked. A lot of hiding abilities can protect you from location effects.
It's not the Dark Essence, Jason said. It's one of my abilities. My, out-of-town abilities?
Ability, mysterious stranger, immunity to identification and tracking effects.
It seems that I'm completely immune to tracking effects, Jason said.
Vincent nodded.
That's fine, he said, just as long as we know there isn't someone messing with our membership systems.
So what does that mean about getting my badge? Jason asked.
There's not much we can do, Vincent said. Your badge will still work fine for your adventuring activities. It just means we can't track you if you go missing, or find your body if you die alone.
I can live with that, Jason said. Tracking everyone seems a little dystopian anyway.
Vincent plucked an object out of thin air. Many Essence users had abilities to store objects in dimensional spaces, like Jason's inventory or Farrah's bottomless stone chest. Vincent handed a square leather object to Jason. It was a badge wallet, which Jason flipped open to see the badge inside. It was a circular medallion made of iron, embossed with a sword and rod crossed over a shield, the emblem of the Adventure Society.
Congratulations, Vincent said. As of this moment, you are officially a member in good standing of the Adventure Society. That badge represents your membership and the authority that represents.
I have authority?
Jason asked, flipping open the wallet like a TV cop flashing his badge.
Not really, Vincent said. There's a certain level of prestige that comes from membership, but any actual authority comes from the contract you are carrying out. A common example is when the city puts out the contract to capture a wanted criminal. Whoever is assigned that contract has the power to investigate and arrest bestowed by the city, but only so long as they are on that contract. You don't have the rank to take on a contract like that, however.
I have a rank? Jason asked.
Your rank can be seen on your medallion, Vincent said. 1-star iron rank.
Jason looked down at his new badge. On the iron medallion underneath the Adventure Society emblem was a single star.
The ranking system of the Adventure Society has 2 parts, Vincent explained. The first element is not assessed at all, being a reflection of your rank as an Essence user. Your iron rank, so you're an iron rank member.
Simple enough, Jason said.
The second part is not an assessment of your power, but your judgment. That's the star ranking, and is wholly determined by the Adventure Society. Everyone begins at one star, with the maximum number of stars being 3. The number of stars determines the kinds of contracts you can take. One-star contracts are pure monster hunts with no complicated elements to deal with.
What's your star rating? Jason asked.
Society officials operate outside the rating system, Vincent said. It helps us to work with members irrespective of their rank.
Makes sense, Jason said. If you've got a 2-star official running an operation with 3-star members, they might start taking things into their own hands.
Precisely, Vincent said.
So what about you two? Jason asked Gary and Farah.
2-star, Farah said.
Rufus as well. We were kind of hoping to get bumped up to 3 after the Vane contract, but that didn't work out.
Rufus gave an honest report, Gary said. We didn't come out looking great.
Ironically, you did, Vincent said to Jason. I saw that report. I don't suppose that counts for my promotion chances?
Not directly, Vincent said, but it may be taken into account in the future, once other achievements have the society considering you for promotion. Achievements made while actually a member.
So what do 2 and 3 stars actually represent? Jason asked.
In short, Vincent said, 2 and 3 stars represent a level of confidence in your judgment on the part of the Adventure Society. 2 stars means the society recognizes your ability to undertake at least some level of actual, unsupervised responsibility. You'll be able to take different kinds of contracts, such as investigating potentially dangerous situations or unknown phenomena. It also means you can lead small expeditions of 1-star members.
We never got to 2-star at Iron Rank, Gary said. In the high magic areas, there isn't a lot of chance to shine. You spend the whole time following more powerful adventurers so as not to die.
3 stars is much the same as 2, but more so, Vincent said.
3 stars means they trust you to handle yourself when things get political, Farah said.
That's a fair assessment, Vincent said. 3-star members are expected to anticipate and manage consequences at a higher level than other adventurers.
How do you go for promotion? Jason asked.
You can apply, Vincent said. Usually on the back of some accomplishment, the society prefers to choose for themselves, however. When they think you're operating at a higher level than your current rank, they'll do an assessment. We don't like to see useful assets wasting themselves on work any idiot could do.
I think he's talking about you, Farah said to Gary.
You're not any higher rank than I am,
Gary shot back. There is one important thing to be aware of, Vincent said, ignoring the pair. The stringency with which promotions are considered scales upward with power. What is good enough for 2 stars at Iron Rank is not the same as at Bronze or Silver Rank, where the stakes are higher. As such, you can expect to drop a star rank each time you increase a tier in power. Unless you're still 1 star, of course. No one really expects anything from you if you're stuck at that level.
He's still talking about you, Farah said.
I have 2 stars, Gary said. We're the same rank.
So what now? Jason asked.
That's easy, Gary said. You're an adventurer now. Go to the jobs hall, get a contract, and have some damn adventures.
Chapter 63 Sunk Cost Fallacy. Jason was trying something new on his morning run to Jory's clinic. With his cloak of shadows around him, he used its ability to reduce his weight to accelerate his progress. It required careful control, kicking off each step with his full weight, then reducing it to let the force propel him. At first, it didn't work at all as he hopped into the air or tripped and fell. Slowly getting a handle on it, he developed an unusual stride. His steps came less frequently, but with a lunging power that sent him skimming almost weightlessly over the ground. The disadvantage was that the weight reduction slowly consumed his mana. By the time he arrived breathlessly at Jory's, the little mana bar at the edge of his vision was as empty as his stamina. He was as exhausted mentally as physically. When Jason staggered through the back door of the clinic, Jory quickly brought in someone for Jason to use his power on.
The patient looked worse than Jason, pale-skinned and walking strangely. He was accompanied into the room by a deeply unpleasant smell. Jason held out a weary hand, mumbling the incantation for the spell.
"Feed me your sins."
"You have cleansed all instances of disease, dysentery, from human. You have cleansed all instances of disease, syphilis, from human. Your stamina and mana have been replenished." Both Jason and the patient let out sighs of relief.
"Thank you, sir,"
the man said to Jason as Jory led him out.
"I couldn't really make it here without soiling myself a little."
"Oh, we noticed," Jory said.
"Did I hear him say something about sins?"
the man asked Jory. "Don't worry about that," Jory said. "You just go home and get yourself cleaned up." Jory came back to find Jason leaning against the wall. The few afflictions he had drained from the patient weren't enough to fully restore him. "What happened to you?"
"I'm trying a new thing with one of my abilities, something to help me travel faster. I'm going to pick up my first contract today, and most of them will be out in the Delta."
"Why not hire a Heidel from the livery stable? That's what most adventurers do." "They creep me out," Jason said. "They're like a horse, except horribly, horribly wrong." "I don't know what a horse is, but why do you think Heidels are creepy?"
"They are creepy."
"There's a leech monster that lives inside you, and you think Heidels are creepy." "Yeah, well, actually, that's a pretty good point. Still, I can think they're creepy if I want. It's a subjective position. Can you help me out with some cheap stamina and mana potions?"
"That's not a problem," Jory said. "Making those on the cheap were some of the earliest results of my experiments. They won't be as strong as the more expensive sort, though."
"That's fine," Jason said. "I just need something to top me off a little. I'll save the high-performance stuff for combat."
"I have crate loads of the cheap stuff," Jory said. "You can have them at cost."
"Thanks," Jason said. "I'll be spending more time out in the Delta now. I probably won't be able to make scheduled appearances so often."
"Don't worry," Jory said. "The clinic got along just fine before you came along."
"I'm not saying I won't be here," Jason said. "It's just the timing might get a little erratic."
"Any time you can spare, I'll appreciate," Jory said. "Things will be a bit hectic once the expansion starts anyway."
"How's that going?"
"I bought the building next door. I'm going to have the two buildings connected, using this one as the clinic and putting a huge alchemy facility in the other. Construction starts in a few days."
"Best bring on the next patient," Jason said. "I want to get through them and head up to the jobs hall."
"Not a problem," Jory said, heading for the door. He paused, looking back at Jason.
"Have you been passing weird spirit coins?"
"Those ones I gave you should have been legitimate."
"Not those," Jory said. "Iron rank stuff. Janice said some magic society guy came in looking for you."
"Is that bad?"
"Not unless you've been passing counterfeit coins."
"I don't think they're counterfeit," Jason said. "Just personalized."
"What do you mean personalized?" Jory asked. Jason took out a coin, checked it with one of his, and tossed it to Jory, who looked it over.
"Is that a picture of you?" Jory asked, peering at it.
"Yep." "Wait a second," Jory said, heading for the stairs. He came back with a stone plate with 6 gems set into it. He sat on a bench and placed Jason's coin on it. The second gem immediately lit up with the blue-gray color of an iron spirit coin.
"The coin's fine," Jory said.
"They're all like this one?"
"They are. Looting ability."
"That's right."
"No wonder you don't mind healing people for free," Jory said. "You can basically punch coins right out of monsters. I'm going to go get some more sick people for you."
"Wait," Jason said. "What do I do about the Magic Society guy?"
"The coins are the real deal," Jory said. "So don't worry about it. You're an Adventure Society guy now. There's something of a friendly rivalry between the Magic Society and the Adventure Society, at least between people who aren't members of both. If he shows up, feel free to stick it to him. Just do what you normally do to people."
"What do I normally do to people?"
"Confuse them until they want to punch you in the face."
The Jobs Hall was an annex of the main administration building on the Adventure Society campus.
Compared to the overbearing immensity of the trade hall, it was small and discreet. Inside was a moderate-sized room divided into rows by standing bulletin boards. There were a few adventurers amongst them, perusing the posted contracts. To the right of the entrance was a stairwell, going up, while the left had a man behind a desk. The familiar-looking man was leaning back in his chair, dozing lightly in the warmth of the afternoon.
"Afternoon, Bert," Jason greeted. He had learned that when it came to the Berts, the best way to identify them was to feel out their auras, which were almost, but not quite, as identical as their faces. This was Albert, an Adventure Society functionary Jason had met before.
"Mr. Asano," Albert greeted. "You're not in for your first job, are you?"
"I am, as it happens."
"You know, there's another young fellow doing the same."
"Oh?" Jason said, looking around. He spotted Humphrey emerging from behind a bulletin board.
"I thought I heard your voice," Humphrey greeted.
After exchanging small talk, they started exploring the bulletin boards. It was the first visit for both of them, but Humphrey had been preparing to be an adventurer his entire life. He acted as a guide as he showed Jason through the various sections.
"This floor is all iron rank contracts," Humphrey explained. "It starts at 1-star contracts down this end, with 3-star on the far side of the room. That section is usually empty, though. Most iron rank contracts are ordinary monster hunting." He pointed out the stairs. "Upstairs is bronze rank. There isn't a spot for silver rank, since there isn't enough call for it."
They started strolling through the rows, glancing over contracts.
"Contracts can be closed or open," Humphrey explained. "A closed contract can only be taken by one person, on a first-come, first-serve basis. You take the notice, register it at the desk, and off you go. Open contracts are a lot less common, where any number of people can join in. Usually that's a widespread infestation of lesser monsters, with rewards per kill."
"I've killed a few lesser monsters."
"They aren't a big problem, unless they come in numbers," Humphrey said. "Any farmer with a pitchfork can handle most of them."
"Not all of them, though," Jason said.
"Have you ever seen a malicious hedgehog? Shoots spikes out of its body."
"I haven't," Humphrey said.
"I suppose you don't get a lot of hedgerow omnivores in this climate."
"When it comes to choosing a contract, not all are created equal," Humphrey said, continuing his explanation. "Once a contract has languished for a couple of weeks, it gets assigned to members on a compulsory basis. As to who gets the assignments, that's all internal politics. There have been some rumblings since the new director came in. There are a lot of nominal Adventure Society members who don't take any contracts, suddenly finding contracts assigned to them."
"I've heard there's been some internal conflict," Jason said. "The new person in charge trying to purge some of the corruption?"
"My perspective has been somewhat peripheral," Humphrey said, "not being a member until now. My mother likes the new director, though."
"That's a good sign."
"The new director had been making a lot of changes," Humphrey said, "even here in the jobs hall."
"Such as?"
"Contracts come from the general population," Humphrey said, "from people who have a problem, usually a monster problem, that requires an adventurer. People of means can offer incentives so that their contract is taken up more quickly. As you might imagine, there's a lot of competition for the more lucrative contracts."
"The new director banned incentives?"
"No, they're still there," Humphrey said. "It's just that there used to be a special notice board up the front with all the incentivized contracts, because they were the ones people were most interested in. The new director put an end to that and had the incentivized contracts posted with all the rest. I'm not really sure what that accomplishes, other than taking up people's time."
"It's actually a smart move," Jason said. "Once people have put in a certain amount of effort into something, they feel like they need to follow through, or their effort was wasted. They call it the sunk cost fallacy, where I come from."
"Sunk cost?"
"Think about that board you described," Jason said. "The one with the most lucrative contracts on it sitting up the front. I bet you'd get a lot of people who come in, saw the board was empty, and walked away. Now think about if they have to comb through all the boards to find those high-paying contracts. After having spent that much time looking, at least some of those people will take a contract, even if they don't find one with bonuses. Otherwise, they feel like they've wasted all the time they spent looking."
Humphrey frowned as he looked at Jason.
"Does it ever bother you?" Humphrey asked.
"Manipulating people, I mean. Like with Fadwick Mercer. If you were actually arguing with him would be one thing, but provoking him because a public argument helps your social standing."
Manipulation isn't bad in and of itself, Jason said. Look at it this way. If you have the choice between manipulating someone into doing the right thing or punishing them for doing the wrong thing, which is more moral? Pushing someone onto a better path to do the right thing or having the wrong thing done and hurting the person for doing it? Righteous honesty says to be upright and put the moral decision onto the other person. But what is more important, feeling righteous or putting a little more good into the world?
You have to give people the chance to make their own mistakes, Humphrey said. Otherwise, you're just trying to control everything, even what's right and wrong.
There is always someone controlling what's right and wrong, Jason said. Look at you, for example. How do you feel about benefiting from a society where the vast majority of the population are exploited for the benefit of you and people like you? The same people who govern the structure of society are the ones who benefit the most. That's true everywhere, your world or mine.
I was brought up to believe that nobility is as much duty as privilege, Humphrey said, that the advantages we have come with a lifelong responsibility to earn everything we've been given.
That's commendable, Jason said, but Thadwick Mercer received every opportunity you did, and he doesn't strike me as the lifelong responsibility type. How many of your peers are like you, and how many are like him? How is that fair to the people of Old City or the Delta? Do you think someone living in a hovel would turn down a mansion because they would have to live up to the responsibility that came with it? Someone like Thadwick isn't inherently evil, but he's part of a system that tells him he deserves more than other people just for being born. Do you think he's right to think that?
Of course not.
But you're the same, Jason said. That responsibility you were talking about? That is you striving to be better because the world tells you that you're better and you feel responsible for living up to that. I respect that choice, but it is a choice. If you wanted to slack off and exploit people, there's very little to stop you. Not everyone gets the chance to live up to that privilege. Farah, had she been present, would have recognized Jason ramping up into full-blown, morally superior proselytizing. Not being there to stop him with a sharp punch to the face, Jason's rant continued. You think criminals just woke up one day and thought, gee, I sure would like to take other people's stuff? They turn to crime because it's that or they go hungry. Their children go hungry. That's something you and I never had to deal with. We get to choose to be good or bad because we don't have to spend our time breaking our backs just to eat or have a roof over our heads. People live their whole lives with nothing but that struggle, birth to death. But we never had to deal with that. And it's not likely we ever will.
Humphrey shook his head.
So what are you suggesting? He asked. Revolution? Bring everything crashing down? It's easy to point at the injustices of the world and use that as an excuse for whatever behavior you're trying to get away with.
I don't have an answer, Jason said, deflating from his self-righteous high. I'm like you, Humphrey. I'm trying to do my best with what I have. In your case, that's talent, wealth, looks, and privilege. As for me, I'm good at people.
You mean good with people? Humphrey said.
No, Jason said. I meant what I said.
Clarissa Ventress's bodyguard, Darnell, led Sophie into the garden, where Ventress was enjoying tea on a terrace.
Sophie, dear, Ventress said. It's been so long since I've heard from you.
I've been busy.
With that little request of mine, yes. But as I recall, what I instructed were high-profile thefts in the midst of public events. It's been weeks, and I haven't heard about a thing. If you were doing as you were told, I really should have.
Your part in planning this operation, Sophie said, was to tell us to do something breathtakingly idiotic. Our part was to figure out how to do that without being caught immediately. Our part is harder, so it takes longer.
Unless your intention was for us to march over to the island and mug the first rich-looking person we see.
Darnell moved forwards threateningly as Sophie raised her voice, but Ventress waved him back.
But I don't think that's what you wanted, Sophie continued. That might get you out of our deal when I'm hauled away by the guard, but everyone will know that you sold me out. Where would your precious reputation be then? Stop sending your goons to drag me back here, Ventress. You're only slowing me down.
2 weeks, Ventress said,
I want to hear about your first bold caper within 2 weeks, or I will consider you as having failed to live up to your side of our little pact, at which point I will throw you to whichever wolf leaves the thickest slab of meat at my door. And if I hear you try to run out on me... She gave Sophie her best serpentine grin. There are men in this city with tastes that would make someone even as hard as you turn soft, Sophie dear. Sophie looked ready to spit venom, but kept her lips pressed tightly together. She stared daggers at Ventress, who smiled back as if Sophie's glare was good for the skin. Can I go now? Sophie asked, biting off every word. Of course, dear, Ventress said. 2 weeks, don't forget now. Chapter 64 Take My Wife, Please. Luckily for Jason, most of the contracts in the jobs hall were for areas close to the city. Unless the threat was urgent, those further afield were posted on each town or village's notice board. Every month, the Adventure Society would send out a number of people to patrol those areas and resolve those notices. It was not a popular task, as it meant a full month away from the city and any opportunities that might arise. Jason started taking one or two contracts a day, depending on the location. He would then try and clear a notice or two off the local boards while he was out, even if it meant spending the night out in the Delta. People were more than welcoming, especially as he took the time to help any sick locals. In the jobs hall, Jason placed a notice on the desk. Albert was on duty again today, making a record of the contract. Badge, please, Albert said. Jason took out his Adventure Society badge and touched it to the contract. There was a shimmer as the badge touched the magic paper and Albert filed it in one of the desk drawers. New quest. Contract. Bog Shambler. A bog shambler has appeared close to the village of Hule. You have accepted a contract to eliminate the creature. Objective. Eliminate bog shambler. 0 of 1. Reward. Spirit coins. The Adventure Society rewarded iron spirit coins for an iron rank monster slaying contract. The amount depended on number of monsters, travel time, and perceived difficulty, from 10 anywhere up to 100. If the contract proved more difficult than was originally assessed, bonuses would be given. They went from extra coins all the way up to an awakening stone, although such a reward was extremely rare. Jason himself could loot coins from each monster, while the quests that appeared for each contract would give more coins again, and sometimes other valuables. He was effectively being paid 3 times for each contract. "Your armor is looking a bit ragged," Albert observed. "That thorny-tongued frog from yesterday." "It certainly was as thorny-tongued as advertised," Jason said. "The armor self-repairs, but it got torn up pretty well. It'll be fine in a few days." "I imagine you got torn up as well." "I self-repair too," Jason said. "You on tomorrow, Bert?" "Nah. They've got me on the admin desk tomorrow. I'll see you in a few then." Jason made to leave, but found someone standing in his path. It was a tall, gangly fellow who looked a few years older than Jason. He had an iron rank aura, so he was probably the age he looked. He was wearing robes that were a size too big, with the emblem of the Magic Society prominently placed.
"Mr. Asano," the man asked.
"And you are?" Jason asked.
"Standish," the man said. "Clive Standish of the Magic Society. To be precise, I am adjunct assistant to the deputy director of the Magic Society, Greenstone Branch."
"That must make for a long desk plate. Is there a reason you're standing in my way, Standish?"
"Actually, Mr. Asano, I've been looking for you for some time."
"Well, it isn't my fault," Jason said. "I had no idea she was your wife, so you can't blame me."
"What?" Clive asked. "I'm not married."
"She told me the same thing," Jason said, shaking his head ruefully. "I wouldn't worry about it." Clive's brow creased into a frown.
"I'm not entirely sure what's going on here."
Jason patted him consolingly on the arm. "Welcome to my life," Jason said, then walked past Clive and out the door. Left alone inside the jobs hall, Clive stood on the spot, confused.
"What just happened?"
"That's Jason," Albert said. "Nice enough guy. A bit odd."
Bert? Clive said, turning to the man behind the desk. I thought you sold fruit.
You're probably thinking of my brother, sir.
In the Delta, Jason had been given a room at the only inn in the village. After clearing out a monster and healing some of the sick, the innkeeper refused to take payment. The room was humble but clean, and Jason sat on the floor performing his evening meditation. Jason had yet to arrive in Greenstone when Rufus told him the three foundations of building his power as an essence user. Training, to prepare himself. Danger, to push his limits. And meditation, to consolidate his efforts. For months, Jason worked on two of the three pillars, under the guidance of Rufus, Farah, and Gary. Without all three, however, his abilities made little progress. Jason was driven to take contract after contract, fighting monster after monster. He was caught up in the heady rush of danger, his skills and powers the line between life and death. It was one of the three pillars Rufus described as the foundations of power advancement, and Jason was starting to see results. The fastest was his vision power, which Farah told him was normal. After all, it was constantly in use. The next fastest was the spell he used to cleanse sickness and poison, Feast of Absolution. It had been crawling slowly but surely upwards as he used it over and over at the clinic. Once he started using it in combat, the slow climb turned into a regular upwards tick. Feast of Absolution was more useful in combat than he anticipated, as many monsters spawned in groups. He could use it on a monster right before finishing it off, replenishing himself on the afflictions he had placed on it himself. The injection of mana and stamina gave him the endurance to go full bore through an extended fight instead of needing to pace himself. Ability, Feast of Blood, Blood, has reached Iron 1, 100%. Ability, Feast of Blood, Blood, has advanced to Iron 2, 00%. It was usually during meditation that Jason's abilities broke through. He smiled with satisfaction, breaking his meditation and taking a sandwich from his inventory to munch on. His abilities grew stronger with each rank, although it was easier to see with some than others. His vision power, for example, not only increased his ability to see through darkness, but also his normal visual acuity. Colors were brighter, distant objects clearer. It was a concrete reminder of what all his efforts were for. He decided that after pushing himself so hard, he would take a few days to rest on returning to the city. He also wanted to look into obtaining more awakening stones. Until he awakened all of his abilities, he couldn't make any true progress towards bronze rank. Jason Asano. Race, Outworlder. Current rank, Iron. Progression to bronze rank, 0%. 0 of 4 essences complete. Attributes, Power, Blood, Iron 0. Speed, Dark, Iron 0. Spirit, Doom, Iron 0. Recovery, Sin, Iron 0. Racial abilities, Outworlder. Interface, Quest System, Inventory, Map, Astral Affinity, Mysterious Stranger. Essences, 4 of 4. Dark, Speed, 3 of 5. Midnight Eyes, Special Ability, Iron 4, 39%. Cloak of Night, Special Ability, Iron 3, 0.8%. Path of Shadows, Special Ability, Iron 3, 21%. Blood, Power, 4 of 5. Blood Harvest, Spell, Iron 3, 0.4%. Leech Bite, Special Attack, Iron 2, 89%. Feast of Blood, Spell, Iron 2, 0.0%. Sanguine Horror, Familiar, Iron 2, 16%. Sin, Recovery, 4 of 5. Punish, Special Attack, Iron 2, 85%. Feast of Absolution, Spell, Iron 3, 96%. Sin Eater, Special Ability, Iron 3, 21%. Hegemony, Aura, Iron 2, 67%. Doom, Spirit, 1 of 5. Inexorable Doom, Spell, Iron 2, 67%. He would only start down the path to bronze rank once all his essence abilities were awakened. Jason didn't feel put upon by his lack of awakening stones, as even Humphrey didn't have his full set of powers yet. According to Humphrey, it was Geller family tradition to supply their scions with enough awakening stones to get started, while the rest had to be earned. The Adventure Society was known to give out awakening stones for exceptional service, although rarely. Usually it was for unexpected success when a contract proved more difficult than expected.
Some open contracts also offered stones as rewards for those with the greatest contributions. The competition would strongly drive performance. Otherwise, awakening stones could be purchased through brokers, almost always at auction. They came up semi-regularly, but the prices were exorbitant. Rufus advised him to be patient and work hard. The Adventure Society made sure stones found their way into the hands of good adventurers. Returning to the city in the morning, Jason stopped at Jory's clinic before returning to his lodgings on the island. Jason's inn was expensive, closer to a luxury hotel than the inns and hostels of the Delta towns. Downstairs was a sumptuous lounge, dining hall and bar. When Jason entered the lounge from outside, he spotted the landlady, Madame Landry, berating a tall man in scholar's robes.
"Think you can sleep in my lounge area like it's a common flophouse?"
Clive was profusely apologizing. Somehow his gangly height seemed lesser than the tiny woman scolding him.
"I fell asleep while awaiting an acquaintance," Clive said. "I'm happy to pay the fee for a night."
"So you do think it's a flophouse?"
"No, good lady, I can assure you that..."
Clive continued struggling until he spotted Jason, his eyes lighting up.
"Mr. Asano," he called out.
Clive fled Madame Landry in Jason's direction.
"Here, good lady," Clive said. "This is my acquaintance, Mr. Jason Asano."
"Who's your acquaintance?" Jason said, voice and expression full of offense. "After you slept with my wife?"
"What?"
Clive said, flustered, head swiveling between Jason and Madame Landry.
"Wait, you're not doing that to me again."
He jabbed a finger in Jason's direction.
"You don't even have a wife."
"Not anymore," Jason said. "She ran off with this tall bloke from the Magic Society."
"You absconded with Mr. Asano's wife and have the nerve to use my inn like some cheap tavern,"
Madame Landry said.
"I never touched his wife."
"I'm off upstairs for a rest, Madame Landry," Jason said. "Probably best if you showed him the door."
"You have a good rest, Jason, dear," she said. "I know you've been working hard."
Clive watched Jason disappear up the stairs and was shuffled outside by Madame Landry. He stood out on the street, looking at the door that had been closed in his face.
What in the world is going on?
Chapter 65. Curious Urges.